Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we once again prepare to dive into the crypt and unearth a true crime tale. Before we get started, as always, I have the normal plugs. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, you can find me under Ian Totten, author, The Deathcast, or Corpse Creek Publishing. If you'd like to stay up to date on what is going on in my world, you can go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com and click on the sign-up button for the mailing list. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the show by clicking on the donate button. No amount is too small, and obviously no amount is too large. A couple other ways you can help support the show. If you listen on Podcast Addict or on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving a 5-star review. Get a shout out if you do when you write one out. And also, please consider joining the Patreon page at tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can get access to exclusive content in cases that I don't cover in the main feed. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, kick back in a chair, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Okay, so we are staying in San Francisco, which is where we were the previous 2 weeks, and we are still in the early to mid-1970s, which, if you'll remember from the two-parter that I did on the San Francisco Death Angels, there was a lot of social upheaval going on in San Francisco during this period of time. This case is one that I had never heard of before, and I actually found it in San Francisco Homicide Inspector 5 Henry 7, which is a book by retired San Francisco homicide investigator Frank Falzone. So I'm going to be using that book as well as various newspaper articles from the period of time when this crime took place and newer ones. The crime I am talking about is the murder of Frank Carlson. Like I said, this is one I had never encountered before. Residents of San Francisco and California in general may be familiar with this case, as it was such a horrific crime. We're also dealing with a very short timeline for this particular crime, but I want to give a warning before I dive into specifics about what took place. This is an extremely brutal rape and murder. So if you're one of those ID channel women who, you know, that you don't want the gory details, you might want to check out now, because you can't talk about this case without talking about what exactly was done and just how brutal it actually was. The crime itself took place on April 18th, 1974, in the Potrero Hill District of San Francisco. Before I jump into what took place, I'm going to be giving you just a brief overview of who the victims were. Frank Carlson was born in December of 1948 in the Richmond District of San Francisco. Frank was followed nearly a decade later by a younger brother, Eric Carlson. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find a lot of information on the type of individual that Frank was, which is something that I try to do. The few accounts I was able to find concerning him basically describe Frank as a good-hearted individual. Frank graduated from George Washington High School in June of 1966. After this, he enrolled at the San Francisco State University, where in June of 1970, he would graduate with a Bachelor of Arts in English Journalism. Frank was a fairly religious man, and in 1965 he met a woman by the name of Annette at a Lutheran church. The two began dating, and in 1971 they were married. Frank was working for Safeway while continuing to look for a job in the journalism field. In 1973, they purchased a home on Kansas Street, which is where they were living on the night of the murder and rape. On the night of April 18th, 1974, the fire department responded to a call of a fire at 1301 Kansas Street in San Francisco. When they arrived, they found a woman and number of individuals huddled on the second story roof. The woman had been wrapped in a blanket. They were able to get her down and sent her to immediately to the hospital, as the woman was in fairly rough shape. The firefighters put out the blaze and immediately found a body in the downstairs. Homicide detectives were contacted and they quickly arrived on the scene. When they arrived on the scene, they found the body of a male who had been tied to a chair with severe head wounds. He had been partially obscured by the dining room table. The body was quickly identified as 25-year-old Frank Carlson, while the woman on the roof was found to be his wife, Annette. Surveying the crime scene, the homicide investigators quickly realized that this was going to be a difficult case to crack, as the fire and the firefighters' efforts to extinguish the flames had done some pretty extreme damage to the crime scene. However, they did find a number of things that were of interest to their investigation, such as a claw hammer that was broken, a 3-inch thick chopping block which had a corner that had been busted off. The corner was found and covered in blood. A shattered wine jug which had been used to store change. And they found this change all over the room, suggesting to the officers that the victim had been hit in the head with all of these objects, and that when he was hit with the wine jug, it had shattered. They also found a bloody shoe print, which they suspected had been made by a boot. This was found on an area of the carpet that wasn't completely destroyed. According to the fire inspectors who were on scene, they believed that the fire had started in the upstairs before quickly spreading downstairs. So the homicide investigators, they're looking at this and they're piecing things together. In their mind, they're thinking, all right, it's fairly obvious that the fire was started in an attempt to hide the real crimes, which was the assault and murder of Frank, as well as whatever had been done to his wife, Annette. At this point, they still didn't know much about what was going on. Eventually, Officer Frank Falzon would head to the hospital where Annette was listed in critical condition. Arriving at the hospital, Inspector Falzon talked with a few nurses who he described in his book as being visibly shaken. A number of them stated that, you know, he needed to go out and catch this individual. Upon talking to the doctor who was taking care of Mrs. Carlson, Frank learned that she was not expected to live from her wounds. Before being informed that Mrs. Carlson was waiting to speak with him, Officer Falzon was taken aback by this obviously, because the woman's in critical condition, and oftentimes someone in that position is either incapable of speaking with police or does not want to, for obvious reasons. But Annette was different than most people, as you are going to see. 24-year-old Annette had been savagely brutalized by her assailant, with multiple lacerations to the face and the scalp. Parts of her scalp had actually been ripped away, which exposed the skull underneath. Thousand later described what he saw upon seeing her, quote, "The skin on her scalp was torn away, and her skull looked like a peeled orange covered in a spongy pith." So this isn't just a simple assault that he's dealing with. Obviously, given the level of brutality he witnessed at the house, now he's got this woman who's barely clinging to life, and she is, you know, been savaged beyond recognition. I think it speaks greatly to Annette's constitution that not only was she able to give a description of what happened, she was more than willing to give a description. Now, according to Annette, she was asleep in her upstairs bedroom while her husband Frank was downstairs. She estimated the time to have been between 11 and 11:30. She was awoken to find a man standing over her bed. The man, who she described as an African-American with a large afro, had placed his hand over her nose and mouth in order to wake her up. Obviously, with everything that's going on in the city at this point, her mind immediately goes to, oh shit, is this the zebra killer? Because if you remember from what I covered the last 2 weeks, when this crime took place was right during the period of time when the zebra killings were going on. It was actually about coming to the end of the zebra killing spree. So her mind immediately jumps to, is this guy the zebra killer? According to Annette, she glanced around the room quickly and noticed that a window in the bedroom was open. Obviously, how the assailant had gotten inside of the house. Annette described the man as in his mid-20s, medium build, maybe 5'8" to 5'10" tall, with a delicate-looking face and a mustache. The man was dressed in dark jeans and a dark shirt, and was holding a knife that had a dark wooden handle on it. She was able to discern that the knife, which was about 3 inches long, had a broken tip. You have to understand how amazing it is that she was able to recall all of this, given what had happened to her, which you're going to learn here in a few minutes. Annette stated that she screamed, which drew her husband from downstairs, and the man quickly subdued Frank. According to Annette, the man stated, "I need some money," and the way he said the word money stuck with her and would actually be one of the key pieces of evidence that would help to bring down the man responsible, as he didn't say money, he said it as Monet, which for people of a certain age may conjure up images from Mel Brooks's History of the World Part 1. One of the characters' last name is Money, and he always states it as Monet. So if you're trying to understand how this guy pronounces it, it's just like that. After being told this, Frank told the man that he can have everything that they have, just please don't hurt them. The man then proceeded to march the couple downstairs. Upon getting downstairs, one of the first things that was apparent was that Frank had been working on the books for the Safeway he worked at, where he was an assistant manager. And so as not to disturb his wife, he'd had the radio on low. After asking the couple for some rope, and being informed that they did not have any, the man left the couple in the dining room and went to a front room where he cut the electrical cord off of a lamp, after which he forced Frank to sit down in a chair and ordered Annette to tie her husband up. Annette ties Frank to the chair with his arms behind his back, after which the assailant went around and made certain that Frank was tied up properly before demanding that Annette go and get the money that was in the house, threatening her not to call the police or do anything stupid. Annette obviously goes and does this, returning with credit cards, $6 in cash, and a large wine jug that had been filled with change. According to Annette, the man forced her to sit in front of the refrigerator as he paced around the downstairs of the house. She pleaded with him not to hurt them, at which point the man said, "Shut up, bitch. Sit down and shut up." This conversation lasted a few moments as the man demanded more money from them, and Annette and Frank tried to explain to him that they didn't keep large amounts of cash inside of their home. Eventually, the man asks Annette if she has a hammer. She states that they do, but it is on the back porch. She goes to retrieve it, is unable to remove the toolbox from the shelf. The man comes and actually takes it from her before going and turning the volume on the radio all the way up. Again, just a warning, we're going to be talking about some graphic descriptions of what happened. So if you're a bit squeamish or you can't handle this type of detail, skip ahead a few minutes. Annette is in the kitchen at this point, pretty much paralyzed with fear, and, quote, "He started hitting Frank on the head with the hammer over and over until the head of the hammer broke off. I was screaming hysterically, but I'm not sure I was making any sound at all. I was petrified with fear. He started hitting Frank, this time with the butcher's block. That broke too. Then he hit him with the bottle of coins until that smashed and the coins went all over." After this, the assailant grabbed a potted plant and smashed this over Frank's head. And while he's doing this, according to Annette, the man is shouting at Frank, "Die, die, why won't you die, you bastard, die." Obviously, Annette is horrified and terrified of what has just happened. She knows that she's next. According to her, the assailant then goes over to the stereo and puts a record on, leaving the volume turned all the way up before approaching her in the kitchen, at which point he attempts to kiss her. Annette stated that she pushed him away and the man said, "If you are not nice, I will kill you," at which point he ordered her upstairs and forced her to sit on the bed, forcing Annette to remove all of her clothing while she did this. Annette stated that at this point, she began to notice things about the man, one of the most prominent being a pair of heavy black boots that he wore, which were filthy with mud. According to Annette, the man stated to her, quote, "I'm high on coke. When I'm high on coke, I can fuck for 3 hours." At which point, the man began to brutally rape Annette for hours on end. I'm not going to get into detail concerning this part. You can use your imagination if you're so inclined, but he pretty much forced her to do any depraved act that you can think of. While this is going on, her mind is desperately seeking something to latch onto so that she doesn't have to think about it. And the first thing she thought of was that the man resembled a member of the SLA, who, if you do not recall from previous episodes, the SLA was the Symbionese Liberation Army who had kidnapped Patty Hearst Again, though, her mind turned to the zebra killings. The man periodically stopped during his assaults of Annette. During these breaks, he would rummage through the room, stealing various pieces of jewelry. Intermingled with all of this, the intruder informed Annette that he was in fact the zebra killer, which was confirming her worst fears. As we know, however, from our coverage of the zebra killings, this was not the case. But it's obvious the man is doing everything in his power to keep this young woman in fear and under his control. Eventually, the man finishes abusing Annette and informs her that he is going to have to kill her, stating, quote, "I have to kill you now. I have no choice. You know who I am, don't you? I've seen you before. You know me." Annette's not in the best of shape at this point, but she admitted to Officer Fazan that she did not, in fact, know who her assailant was. And she informed the man of this, but he would not listen to her. And it was at this point that he went from sexually assaulting her to moving on to the next act of depravity. The man ended up cutting the line from the telephone off and attempting to strangle her with it, all while Annette pleaded for her life. The man, however, was not swayed by the things that Annette was saying. He informed her that he had been to jail before, and for these crimes, he was certain that he would go to the gas chamber, so there was no way he was going to allow her to live. It was at this point that the man picked up a rocking chair that was inside of the bedroom and began to smash it down on top of Annette. Her will to live, however, was much greater than this man could have possibly understood, as Annette goes and grabs a pillow and uses it to try and deflect some of the blows from the chair, shielding herself with it. When the rocking chair eventually broke, the man quickly found a glass paperweight, wrapping it inside of a towel, at which point he began to beat her with it. And this was just too much for Annette. She collapses to the ground, barely able to speak, asking the man to just please let her die. The man then approached Annette and used the knife on her, slashing open the artery on her left wrist. And then the man leaves Annette alone, but not to simply escape from the house or go rummaging for more valuables. He actually finds a can of paint thinner, which he douses around the room and in the closet before setting fire to it, before fleeing the room and heading downstairs, where he repeats the process in the dining room. It was later determined by police that the man most likely walked out the front door after doing this. Now you have the horrific crime that took place, the assailant's gone. Annette's not dead, though. Like I said, this woman's constitution, her desire to live, was so far beyond what her assailant could possibly comprehend. She was able to crawl from the bedroom out onto the roof, which was just outside of their bedroom windows, tumbling down onto the gable, where she lay screaming for help. Now, Cross the Street was an organization known as the Synanon Foundation Center. At the time, the Synanon Center was a rehabilitation facility. Yes, I'm aware that they would go on to be labeled as a cult by the United States government, called the Church of Synanon, and that numerous of members would be convicted of various crimes, everywhere from rape to attempted murder. But during this period of time, they were not a bad organization, at least as far as our story goes. You've got these individuals across the street in this Synanon Center. inside of this building, a 23-year-old by the name of Andy Rockwell was sleeping inside of his dormitory when he heard what he thought were the mewings of a cat coming from across the street. He looked out the window and saw the house aflame as well as the woman out on the roof. So Andy gets dressed as quick as he can and runs across the street, unaware that other members of the Synanon facility had also heard this noise and were also in the process of getting over to the house. In concert with all of this, you have people who were living on the street also converging on it. Because of this, Andy, another member of the Synanon house, and two neighbors were able to get up onto the roof and wrap a net inside of a blanket, where they stayed because at this point they can't get down. So they stayed there with a net on the roof, trying to comfort her and keep her calm until help arrives. Eventually, firefighters arrive because somebody saw all of this and called the fire department, and they, in concert with the neighbors and the two men from the Synanon organization, are able to get Annette off of the roof, at which point she is transferred to the hospital. This was roughly around 3:14 to 3:20 in the morning, which should give you some idea as to how long Annette's ordeal lasted. If you'll remember, she stated that she was awoken by the intruder between 11 and 11:30 p.m. It's now roughly 3:20 in the morning, and she's being rescued. So after speaking with Annette, Inspector Falzon asked her if there was any distinguishing features about the man, which she said there were not, but she did inform him that she would be willing to give a description to a police sketch artist, as she stated that she would never forget this man's face. And that's something important in this case, just as the man's pronunciation of the word money was. He spent so much time with Annette, hours upon hours, that she was really able to burn that man's face into her mind. So we have this crime, we have Annette in the hospital, they don't think she's going to live. Spoiler alert, she does. Like I said, she refused to die. The police have this crime, but they really don't have any suspects or witnesses that they're aware of. Now, after meeting back up with his partner, Inspector Falzon related to him Annette's story, and upon the mention of the word money and how the man pronounced it as Monet, his partner informed him that the man was Creole, which is to say, from Louisiana. The officers went back to their office and began investigating as best they could. As I already stated, they didn't have a whole lot to go on. They fairly quickly established that the money and valuables that had been stolen from the house were secondary, and that the rape of Annette was the primary target of their assailant. So with this information, they began tracking down known rapists who had recently been released from prison. This really didn't turn up any leads. An interesting piece, however, from the autopsy of Frank Carlson came from the coroner who was doing it when he stated, quote, "You could drop a man off a 10-story building by his feet and not cause that much damage to his head." On April 20th, the police returned to the hospital where Annette was still kicking and were able to get her to give a composite sketch of the man who had assaulted her. With this, they really began in earnest to look for this individual. This attack had really frightened the people of San Francisco in connection with the zebra killing, so much so that the San Francisco Gazette actually ran an article where they quoted the police department as stating there was no connection to the zebra killing. On that same day, April 20th, Frank Carlson was laid to rest, with his family asking that any donations that were going to be made instead be given to the Synanon Foundation as well as Frank and Annette's church. Now, in addition to looking at any recently paroled rapists that they could find, the police also looked into the residents of the Synanon facility, because at this time, as it stated, it was a rehabilitation facility, but it was also known for taking in convicts who had a problem with drugs and alcohol and attempting to get them clean and sober. So they started looking into this organization, the people who were at the rehab facility, but unfortunately they were not able to turn up any leads. So the police are really out in force trying to solve this crime. Obviously, it shocked the neighborhood as well as the city at large. They're unable to turn up any good leads. And eventually, those leads that they did have or that they were able to come up with fizzled out, and the detectives were left with few avenues to pursue. This wouldn't last long, however, as during the course of their investigation, they had learned that Annette's father was an engineer, and they surmised that his artistic abilities coupled with his daughter's total recall might be able to produce sketches of the pieces of jewelry that had been stolen from the house. The reason why they figured this might help is oftentimes when things like this are stolen, they're either fenced through a pawn shop or somebody will purchase them from the perpetrator. When you're dealing with high-end pieces of jewelry, too, there's oftentimes distinguishing marks that are placed on them. This could be anything from a date stamped inside of a ring to a number that is placed on the piece of jewelry in an unobtrusive area so that the piece of jewelry can later be traced in the event of something happening to it, such as a burglary or it's destroyed in a fire, so that the homeowner and the owner of the jewelry can collect insurance money from it. They were also helped in this by the fact that the jewelry that Annette had, much of it had actually belonged to her grandmother on her father's side, so both of them knew these pieces of jewelry fairly well. So the two of them made these sketches of the jewelry. They produced 6 sketches in total, with really the most important one being of a platinum wedding band. And inside of this wedding band, there was an inscription, Frank and Elizabeth 2444. This was her paternal grandparents' names, coupled with their wedding date. And Annette knew this piece very well, as it was in fact her own wedding band that she had been gifted by her father to use when she was married. So the police took these sketches and included them in the packets that they were putting up around the city looking for information related to the killings. They also contacted the media, and the media agreed to run with this piece of the story, showing these new sketches on the news, as well as including them in newspaper reports. And this piece of evidence is really going to lead to the break in the case that the police were looking for. As on May 10th, on May 10th, this is a day after the story about the stolen pieces of jewelry ran, an individual by the name of John Hearn, who worked at the Gensler Lee Jewelers, clipped out this article and began comparing everything that they had in the store to what was in these drawings, and he found a piece that matched the description of one of the stolen items. This turned out to be Annette's wedding ring, which is the one that had the inscription inside of it. Taking the ring, they drove to the hospital where Annette was and showed it to her, and she was easily able to identify it. After this, the officers went back to the jewelers and asked him where they had gotten it. And according to the man, Hearn, a customer, a male, had brought it in and wanted to have the ring redesigned as a men's ring using the same stones that were set into it. They were able to get the man's name as well as his address, located over in the Hunters Point District. The cops go to this guy's house believing that they've got their man, but they quickly learned that they did not, in fact, have Frank's murderer. After pressing the man and letting him know what information it was that they had, he quickly realized that buying this wedding ring wasn't just some simple transaction that he had been involved in, but was in fact a murder and rape investigation. The man quickly started talking to the officers. He claimed that he had purchased it from his brother-in-law, and that his brother-in-law had gotten it from a co-worker at the post office. To keep this witness from talking to his brother-in-law, the officers arrested him on possession of stolen property before going to speak with the brother-in-law. From the brother-in-law, they learned that he had purchased the ring from a man by the name of Angelo Pavagu. Angelo told the brother-in-law that he had stolen the wedding ring. The brother-in-law had no issue with this and told Angelo that there was a very good chance his brother-in-law would be interested in purchasing the ring. So he ends up setting the two men up and his brother-in-law purchases the ring from Angelo, paying $300. They start looking into this Angelo Pavagu, and they learned that he was a 25-year-old who had been born in Louisiana. He was a truck driver for the post office who lived at 1385 Kansas Street, which is the same street that the Carlson family lived on. He lived on the opposite end of it. On May 11th, officers staked out Angelo's house. They did this because they knew he had a wife and daughter, and they didn't want to just go bursting in there, because in situations like this, you never know how a suspect is going to react. He might lash out violently at the officers, which could lead to a gun battle, or he might take one of his family members hostage, which now turns a simple arrest into, you know, a possible homicide. If the man refuses to give up or feels that he's being threatened, he may take the lives of his hostages. So they stake out his home on the 11th, and as Angelo is coming out of the house, the officers instantly recognize him from the sketch that had been drawn up from Annette's memory. He goes down easily, refusing to speak as he is handcuffed. Now that they've got him back at the police precinct, the officers begin to interrogate Angelo. He claims that he had nothing to do with the murder. However, when pressed on the issue and informed that they are going to be obtaining a search warrant for his house, Angelo admits to having purchased the stolen property, stating, "I went out for a cigarette between 11 and 12 o'clock that night. I know the time because Johnny Carson was on TV. I was sitting on my front porch smoking and watching my puppy. This black guy came running down the street, dropped a bag, and kept going. I didn't get a look at him. I opened the bag, and there were all these rings and bracelets in there. Angelo takes the bag inside and claimed that later he heard all of the commotion coming from the fire trucks and police cars, but didn't think anything of it. Even when his wife informed him the following morning that there had been a murder. And it really gives you an idea of his character that even after information about these rings and what have you were released to the public, he didn't think that, hey, you know what? I have this bag. Maybe I should turn it in. So Pavlou claims that he sold two of the rings, although he had kept the rest of the jewelry, which was in a bag in his bedroom. After signing a consent of search form, officers did in fact find the jewelry in his house. They get Annette to come down to the police station for a lineup, and the police went through the normal procedure of having each individual walk forward, turn left, turn right, turn around, before having them state, "I want the money." And it was this piece that really cinched the noose around Angelo's neck, as when he stated, "I want the money," it came out, "I want the money." So, who is Angelo Pavlou? He was born in New Orleans, and served in the army during Vietnam before being honorably discharged in 1971. Angelo moved to San Francisco in June of 1972, where he worked various jobs, including working for Pacific Telephone as a cable installer, the Young Patrol Service, and finally the post office, where he began working in November of 1973. Angelo was actually terminated from this job as an, quote, unsatisfactory employee, although the post office rehired him the same day after some discussions, as it was thought that Angelo had some potential. After charging Angelo with the murder and booking him, the officers began to go over his personal effects that had been found when he was taken into custody. And one of the items that they discovered was a small black address book. And now inside of this address book, they found the name of a woman who, it turned out, lived about a block from the Carlson's house. After making contact with this woman, they learned that Angelo had gone to her house at roughly 11 p.m. on the night of the murders. And she stated that Angelo was agitated as he claimed to have had an altercation with a, quote, punk on the street. According to this woman, Angelo claimed that he had slapped the piss out of the guy and taken a knife from him. The knife in question he supposedly showed to this woman. The woman noted that the knife was thin and had a broken tip. Angelo asked the woman if he wanted to get high with him, and she is said to have told him that he already looked like he was high. After this, Angelo informed her that he needed $5,000 to buy a pound of coke. He also attempted to get the woman to go back to the bedroom with him, stating, quote, "When he's loaded, he can fuck for 3 hours." Obviously, this is the same thing that the killer had told Annette, and the officers took great interest in this piece of information. Now, this woman, she had picked up a butcher knife when Angelo removed the knife from his waistband. I imagine that she knew something was off with him and was feeling nervous, because Angelo informed her at least twice that he was going to have sex with her, and eventually she informed him that that was not going to happen. Angelo laughed at her and then left the apartment. This at roughly 11:30. Angelo ends up going on trial for this murder, and the case against him is extremely solid, with the state being so confident that they have the right guy, they actually seek the death penalty. Now, during the trial, obviously, Annette took the stand and testified as to what happened. During cross-examination, the defense counsel repeatedly referred to the man responsible for the crime as the suspect, and Annette would counter him with, "Mr. Grimm, the man who you call the suspect is Angelo Pavlyu, and he's sitting right next to you." Which, obviously, if you are a defense attorney and you're being told this by the victim of the crime, you have to know that your chances of winning this case are slim to none. Nevertheless, they pressed on. The prosecutors ended up calling the woman who had informed them of Angela going to her house with the knife and uttering the infamous line, "When I'm high on coke, I can fuck for 3 hours." This corroborated what Annette had stated during her testimony. One unusual bit from this trial, however, is that the defense chose not to give an opening statement, instead calling Angelo's wife to take the witness stand. She testified that on the night of the murder, Angelo had come home around 10 p.m., agitated over a fight he had had with someone out on the street. She stated that Angelo had left after informing her of this fight and did not return home until roughly 12:30, at which point he went to bed. This is not looking good for the defense, as later on it will be brought up that Angelo had told the officers that he had found the bag of stolen jewelry outside when a black man had dropped it while running past his house, and that in fact the following day his wife had mentioned to him about the murder. What Angelo's wife did say is that her husband was so agitated that twice that evening he had gotten up to walk their dog, and during the second trip outside, they had both heard the fire sirens. Angelo himself took the stand in his own defense, and his story at this point completely changed. He said he had been drinking on the night in question and had not used any cocaine, and that he had a passing acquaintance with Mrs. Carlson, having recognized her from the bus. Again, he made no mention of the found bag of jewelry or having seen a man running from down the street. Eventually, he would be found guilty of murder and rape and be sentenced to death plus 54 years. Now, you would think that our story is over at this point, and for the most part it is, but there are a couple of things that need to be discussed. California's Supreme Court overturned the state's death penalty, as did the United States Supreme Court. Because of this, Angelo's sentence was converted to a life sentence with the possibility of parole. Some families do not get involved in situations like this, but the Carlson family is not some family. They have petitioned the court every time that Angelo Pavlyu has come up for parole, appearing at his parole hearings, as well as getting the officers and various members of the court who were involved in the case to write letters to the parole board demanding that he not be released, which so far has worked. And one of the reasons I decided to cover this case is that while doing research for it, I came across a website called justiceforfrank.org, which is maintained by Frank Carlson's family. Angelo Pavague is up for parole again this year. During his last parole hearing, which was 3 years ago, he waived his right to a hearing, which in California, they changed the laws. It used to be you get them every 3 years or 2 year or 1 year. Now, if you're denied parole, it extends the period of time between your parole hearings. But because he was able to waive his right to a parole hearing, his case has not had the period of time between the hearings extended. So he is up for parole again this year. And the family is concerned, rightfully so, that if he decides to go for parole this time around, he may in fact be allowed out. And on this website, you can sign up for updates from them and keep in the loop on this case, as when his parole hearing is coming up, they're going to ask everybody who signed up to write letters, sign petitions to the California Board of Parole in an effort to keep Angelo Pavague behind bars. And when I saw that, I said, you know, this SOB does not need to be out walking the street. And if I can get the message about this case out there to, you know, a few thousand people more than who might normally hear it through the podcast, I'm going to go ahead and cover it. And that is why I've decided to cover this case, so that more people can hear about it. Go visit the website justiceforfrank.org and become involved in trying to keep this vicious, convicted rapist and murderer behind bars. So that is the end of our tale. I have tried to find some information on Frank's widow, Annette Carlson. She has kept an extremely low profile, which is her right, and given the circumstances of what happened to her, I cannot blame the woman. Although she does give interviews on occasion to various news organizations in order to keep her deceased husband's story fresh in the mind of people in an attempt to help keep Angelo behind bars. With all of that being said, we are at the end for this week. I thank you for joining me as we looked at the murder of Frank Carlson and the horrific rape of his wife, Annette. If you enjoyed the show, please go to your favorite podcast app, be it Apple Podcasts or Podcast Addict. Leave a 5-star review, subscribe to the show, share it online, and lastly, go to justiceforfrank.org, sign up on their mailing list so that when Angelo Pavague's parole comes up, you can help keep this SOB behind bars. Until next week, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid!